It is Wednesday, November 28, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. The Northwest Arkansas Women's Shelter will hold its Fresh Start Art Auction Thursday from 6:30 until 9:30 p.m. at Serendipity in downtown Rogers. This fundraiser will feature works from professional artists as well as the shelter's art program. More information available on the web at nwaws.org. And support for KUAF comes from Heartwood Gallery, hosting a holiday open house and 10th anniversary celebration Saturday from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. at 428 South Government Street in Fayetteville. Works from 30 local artists will be available. Refreshments and entertainment will be provided. HeartwoodGallery.org or 444-0888 for more information. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, analyzing the motivation of Arkansas voters this fall. Roby Brock and Jay Barth, co-creators of a poll asking Arkansans about why they voted the way they did this month, discuss those findings. Plus, Mazur, an artist with public works in Dublin, Prague, and Fort Smith, explains what's behind the Art Hill exhibit tomorrow night in Fayetteville. First, information outlined in an independent study shows Arkansas is making progress with efforts to build the state's knowledge-based economy. Mitch Horowitz works for the technology firm that completed the review. He says recent increases in university-based research are paying off, coupled with noticeable growth due to implementation of Governor Beebe's 2009 long-term economic statewide development plan.
A number of programs got put in place that ended up serving about 135 emerging companies that today employ almost 1,300 workers. And when you look at what that has done in such a short period of time, that actually translates into a total impact of over 3,000 jobs here in Arkansas. And they're good-paying jobs. Almost double the average salary that you see in the private sector.
Horowitz says finding ways to increase per capita income and make sure companies are market ready will be central points of discussion during the upcoming legislative session. Washington County is now under a red flag fire warning, effective since yesterday. A red flag warning means there is a high risk that fires could start and spread rapidly, making them difficult to control. While no outright ban on burning has been issued, officials urge county residents to avoid burning if at all possible. The fire warning comes as Fayetteville continues to have a precipitation deficit of about 17 inches below average amounts for the year. So far this month, less than an inch of rain has fallen in the city. The dry and windy conditions contributed to the fire warning. The Springdale City Council last night approved the purchase of two parcels of land for new parks in the city. The two land parcels add up to just under 200 acres of new parkland inside the city limits. Springdale Finance Director Wyman Morgan says the land parcels in question are ideal for the city's needs.
The location is the correct place for placement in the city. We've got the park in the southwest and one in kind of the center, not quite northwest. So we're kind of short on parkland in the southeast part, and then further north we're short. So the location is right for balancing the parks throughout the city, plus it's vacant land.
The parkland is being purchased as part of the more than $70 million bond package voters approved in August. Morgan says the land purchases should be finalized in the next couple of weeks. After that, the parks will go to the design phase. Morgan says it will be nearly a year before the designs are final and the projects advertised for contractors' bids. Although the Northwest Arkansas Hazmat Response Team will be dissolved at the close of this calendar year, a new hazmat team will take its place in Benton County as 2013 begins. The new team will not be a centralized entity. Under the new system, smaller cities and the county administration will pay the same 38 cents per capita for hazmat response that they paid to the old regional organization. Marshall Watson is the public safety administrator for Benton County.
Bentonville, Bella Vista, Rogers, Siloam, and Springdale, those large municipalities will actually provide the response for unincorporated Benton County and the smaller municipalities. They will not actually provide payment into the system since they are the actual providers themselves and have inherent costs associated with that.
While some cities that were members of the old regional hazmat organization have decided to go their own way, Watson says taking a countywide approach in Benton County is better for the cities involved.
Ultimately, the overall cost for operation is going to be lower. We also recognize that no one single entity in Northwest Arkansas is an island, if you will. Most of us are going to face a time and a circumstance and a response that's going to warrant mutual aid. What we've done in Benton County is we've simplified it. We've looked at the things that may have led to the failure of the regional team, and we've simplified it to eliminate some of the overhead and some of the operational aspects.
Watson says the new configuration will effectively cut the overhead costs and internal management that partially led to the demise of the regional hazmat team. The University of Arkansas in Fayetteville has received many honors in the past few months, and there is more recognition. Yesterday, the university announced the Faye Jones School of Architecture is twice ranked number one in a national survey of top brands in architectural education. The survey, conducted by the Design Futures Council, lists the Faye Jones School as tied for number one in the nation in the category of top schools for regional respect and admiration. The school tied with California Polytechnic State University and the University of Oregon. Faye Jones School also tied for the top spot in the Best Small School Design Program category, sharing that honor with Rice University and the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Though not number one, the school is also ranked 19th in the nation among America's Best Architecture and Design School, a study also conducted by the Design Futures Council. Yesterday, Arkansas's congressional delegation issued a letter to the U.S. Air Force in response to its proposed fiscal 2013 budget. Senators Pryor and Bozeman, Representatives Crawford, Griffith, Ross, and Womack, and Representative-elect Cotton issued the letter to express their disapproval of the budget, which cuts the A-10 flying mission of the 188th Fighter Wing in Fort Smith. According to the letter, the 188th employs nearly 1,000 part and full-time workers, and the fighter wing is a textbook model in terms of operational readiness and efficiency while remaining cost-effective. The delegation also urged Chief of Staff General Mark Welsh to visit the 188th to get a better picture of the unit's capabilities. Should be clear tonight, lows in the lower to mid-30s throughout the listening area. Clear tomorrow morning, then a few clouds in the afternoon. Highs tomorrow around 65. And for Thursday night, clear in the evening, and partly cloudy with a low of 41. This is Ozarks at Large. With yesterday's runoff results now tabulated, the 2012 election is finally over. But the ripples from the choices voters made this fall are just beginning. A poll of more than 1,000 Arkansas voters, taken in the hours and days just after the counting of votes had ended, reveals what motivated many to make their decisions. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business and Jay Barth, a distinguished professor of politics at Hendricks University, are the architects of the poll, and this week they discussed what that poll tells us.
The first question we asked involved issues. What one issue was more important to you in determining your vote for president? And here's what we found, that 47% said that economy and jobs were number one. 13% said the federal budget deficit was their number one issue for voting for president. Only 4% foreign policy, 19% said health care, and 17% said some other issue. So tell me, the economy and jobs are the most important to nearly half, which is a little bit less than what we saw nationally, which was around 60%. Why do you think there was a little bit of a difference?
Well, I do think that's a significant gap. And the Arkansas economy clearly has not had the same travails that the national economy has had. I think that's the key issue. The basic pattern across the issue areas was very consistent with the national, but I do think there's just less intensity about economic issues because, you know, Arkansans have not felt that same angst. That said, it's still, when you have an issue that is most important to half the electorate, that's not inconsequential.
That's still a very dominant issue. Yeah. Still, though, health care was something that we heard a lot about anecdotally. It was certainly in a lot of political messaging, but it was less than one-fifth of the actual electorate's number one issue. Right. Did that surprise you that health care was not more predominant in Arkansas?
That was pretty much about the same as the national numbers. Probably wasn't super surprising, but you're totally right. It was really the thread that the Republican Party really used to link President Obama to state Democrats. Obamacare, Medicaid expansion, And so it clearly was the most discussed issue in a lot of communications that we saw go out during this campaign. And so for that reason, because we didn't have much of a statewide campaign in Arkansas, the issue that was arguably talked about the most was health care. And so that may be a little surprising. But I think people, in terms of the issues that they care most about, I mean, it's really about their lived lives. And what folks are most concerned about is their own economic livelihood and where it's going in the future.
And we've seen that in a lot of other polling that we've done. Let's look at another issue that we asked about, another question we asked, and that dealt with the qualities that a candidate has for office. Mm-hmm. What was the most important quality of a candidate for whom you voted? We found that 21% said that he cares about people like me. 14% say he's a strong leader. 32% said he shares my values. 22% that he had a vision for the future. And 11% some other quality is what they were looking for. Did those results, which are somewhat mixed and muddled, did that surprise you?
Well, what we saw in comparison to national numbers was the values issue really did seem to matter here more than in other states in the country. And so I think that's the most telling one, and Governor Romney won that overwhelmingly. And I do think that, you know, that disconnect between President Obama and Arkansas voters, especially white rural Arkansas voters, I think that really was the story of this election and really did shape the Arkansas electorate and had some ramifications down the ticket.
Well, that said, Mitt Romney did not necessarily have values that connected with an Arkansas voter. He's Mormon. He's ultra wealthy. Right. I mean, he comes from the western part of the United States, or Massachusetts, depending on where you want to pinpoint him geographically. Yeah. So why did that not necessarily resonate for Romney?
Well, I do think that, we had in many ways, the cultural divide that has been created with Arkansas voters between Barack Obama on race grounds, on his sense of being from an urban area, and his the perceptions about his religion, and then we have, of course, the class issues and the religious issues that Romney faces. So I think neither of these candidates was a great fit for the Arkansas electorate. I think that's pretty clear, and I think it's one reason we saw turnout go down in this election cycle in Arkansas compared to 4 years ago. So I think there was some disconnect across the board, but I think when push comes to shove, I think it was some of the issues that Barack Obama has faced, including his race, that really was the big divide here.
All right, our final question in the presidential battery involved voting for or against a candidate. Was your vote for a president primarily a vote for one candidate or against another? Again, interesting results. 69% said they voted for a candidate. Now, that could be Romney or Obama voters. Mm-hmm. And 27% said they voted against a candidate. 4% mm-hmm. really didn't have an opinion. Mm-hmm. So that does that kind of destroy the myth that we heard anecdotally floating about before the election that I'm really voting against a particular candidate. I'm voting against Barack Obama. I'm voting against Mitt Romney, when it seems that they clearly had some other motivation.
Well, I think some of those voters who are kind of, most driven to vote against somebody just don't turn up to vote at all, right? And so I think that's one thing that we saw the turnout go down. But, I think in the end of the day, especially because Mr. Romney really performed quite ably at points in the stretch run of the campaign, it really gave voters who were already going to vote for him a reason to vote for him. And I think it did change. I think those numbers are different than Mitt Romney was always going to win the state. But because he did perform ably, especially in the first debate and in the stretch run of the campaign, I think it gave more folks a reason to vote for him, especially on leadership grounds and some of those other factors that we talked about.
Excited the base a little bit there. One of the things we talked about too, and you and I throughout this last election cycle, is we've seen some changes between independent voters, mm-hmm. how they kind of lean. Maybe walk us through a little bit of that data of what we've been seeing.
Right. Historically in Arkansas, since we've had public opinion poll data, and the Arkansas poll from the University of Arkansas is our best measure, Arkansans who consider themselves independents, who don't naturally align with either party, have historically either leaned Democratic slightly or been pretty split between the two parties. What we saw in this election cycle is that those folks who are independents are emphatically leaning Republican. And we know from the political science literature that those folks who lean towards a party are pretty much almost as partisan in their behavior as the folks who identify with a given party. And so these folks who lean Republican, most of them vote Republican, just like, of course, Republican identifiers do. And this is really consequential for the future of politics in this state, because if you have a combination of a third of the electorate that is Republican and then another chunk of the electorate that are independents who lean Republican, that reaches a point where we really do have pretty much a majority Republican electorate in Arkansas, and that has all kinds of ramifications for 2014 and the years ahead.
Do you see this as something that has been building over time? Do you see this as a one-cycle, two-cycle trick pony, so to speak?
Well, I think it clearly has evidenced itself over the last couple of cycles in the Obama era. I'm not yet convinced it's not a permanent change. Is that I think that there were some things that some tides that were leaning in this direction, and then Barack Obama and the kind of negative reaction to him in the state, I think may have locked in some of those attitudes that were kind of floating around out there for a number of years before.
Jay, let's go to the second half of our latest survey, which was conducted less than a week after the election among more than 1,100 voters statewide who actually cast ballots in this November's election. We asked voters if they voted for or against Issue 5, which was the proposal to legalize the medical use of marijuana. Our post-election survey found that 41% were for the measure, while 59% were against it. And that is a far cry from the actual results, which showed 51% were opposed to it and 51% were opposed to it, 49% were for it, actually. However, we know we got a very accurate assessment in this poll because our presidential numbers, which were also in this survey, were spot on, 61-36, 61-37. So how do you describe this discrepancy in these medical marijuana numbers? Yeah. They're 8 points under where things landed and 8 points over where things landed.
Yeah, it's interesting. Arkansas was one of the states where the exit polls were canceled this year, and that's one reason we did this poll. And so we're getting folks a few days later. And I think what we may have is what we might call a reverse Bradley effect. And this goes back, it's a name that's used in polling, it goes back to the early 1980s when Tom Bradley was running for governor of California. And at the time, he would have been the first African-American governor of that state and the only African-American governor in America. And in advance of the election, he was shown to be up fairly comfortably. Yet when the election happened, he lost fairly solidly. And so pollsters were like, what happened? And the only answer was that folks were trying to get the approval of those folks asking them the questions on the front end, and they wanted to show, you know, their support for an African-American candidate, but they couldn't pull the lever, so to speak. And so I think here we may have a little bit of a reverse Bradley effect, in that our pre-election polling also showed lower numbers for the measure, and then we have it still a few days later when people have actually already cast a vote. So I think it's quite interesting. I think the patterns across the different groups are probably on target here, but I think we have to have a caveat about the overall numbers because of some social pressure, arguably, to not support this thing.
Well, and going forward, because this issue is likely to be back in 2 years, if not even cycles after that. So how do we as pollsters, how do we look at some of that data going forward when we get the next poll results and we see maybe a wider variation than what we know actually turned out on election day? How do you judge?
Yeah, it's a great question, and political public opinion polling has really gotten a lot of attention this election cycle, and there are clearly some challenges that all pollsters are faced. We've had pretty good luck in polling in Arkansas.
Skill slash luck.
But this is one we got off. And it's a great question. And we really aren't able to figure out if we knew which subgroup was lying, then we could, kind of adjust for that. But we really just don't have that. So I think the key will be, weirdly, if this thing is polling at or near majority support going into the next election, I think it'll look pretty good for the advocates of this thing.
All right, let's talk about one of the questions we asked. We asked what the reason for or the decision for their support was necessarily, and our poll found out that 66% of the medical marijuana supporters said that the compassionate alternative for those who are sick and in pain was a major reason for them. 22% said it's just time to legalize medical marijuana, whether it's medical or not. And And then we had 12% that had some other reason for voting for this measure. The compassion argument is clearly an effective one for supporters, is it not?
Right, and this was the messaging at the heart and soul of the proponents' argument for voting for Issue 5, and so it seemed that their message worked, it resonated. This was not simply, you know, folks who wanted to legalize pot, but this was really a very different kind of issue. And I think if the campaign had not been successful in that messaging that we see in this poll, this would have been blown out. But it clearly worked. They had an effective campaign. And I think the advertising, which featured folks who could have gotten relief or say they found relief in medical marijuana, I think that really did work quite well.
Roby Brock is the editor and publisher of TalkBusiness.net. Jay Barth, a distinguished professor of political science at Hendricks University. They created the Talk Business Hendricks College Poll. Support for TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at BankOzarks.com. And Verizon, offering a wide selection of productivity-enhancing tablets for small business, including the Apple iPad. More information at a Verizon communication store near you or online at VZW.com/smallbusiness. And CEG Partners, using empirical data to better understand your customers' experiences and their loyalties. More information at CEGpartners.com.
What's happening in Israel, Gaza, Egypt, Syria, Iran, Iraq, it's all interconnected with a lot of shifting and paradoxical alliances that are difficult to explain. Which is why on the next Fresh Air, we talk with Robert Malley, the International Crisis Group's Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa. Join us.
Fresh Air tonight at 6 on KUAF 91.3 FM. There are several special holiday fairs and sales going on in the coming days and weeks in our region. One such event, the Block Street Christmas Bazaar. It's Sunday. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis talked with Hannah Withers, the president of the Block Street Business Association, about this year's version of the event.
First of all, what can people expect from the Block Street Bazaar?
Block Street Bazaar, this is our second annual, and it is a great way to kick off the local independent shopping season. This is sort of Block Avenue's answer to the big box Black Friday sales. We have a lot of shops that are offering sales. We have a lot of shops that are introducing activities. You can stop and make a stocking at I Am Spa. You can sit and listen to the Grinch, read The Grinch Who Stole Christmas in front of Little Bread Company. We have local potters who will be doing their annual soup bowl sale. We have French Quarter Antiques who will have Pierre Noel at his location, and you can donate canned good for the Northwest Arkansas Food Bank to get your picture taken with him. It's a way for us to celebrate the unique stores that we have in our community that are locally owned and independent, and it gives all of us a little bit of a chance to show our personality and what we do in our shops.
Now, you said this is the second year for the bazaar. What did you and other businesses on the street learn from last year, and what's different this year?
Last year was exciting because we had a wonderful turnout and it was really, really cold. It was cold and it was sleety and it was rainy, and we still had a ton of people that bundled up and came out. We offered outdoor marshmallow toasting and fire pits and things to do to keep warm outside, and still sort of made it a family-friendly event, and we had a great turnout. We're doing the same thing that we did last year, but we're making it a little bit more family-friendly. I think it was a great opportunity for people to come and shop and bring their kids with them, which is hard to do when you go to the mall or go to those big stores. It gives them something hands-on to do while you can walk in and out of the shops. So it's a great chance for the shops to highlight local artists that do things in their stores and also offer sales and an answer to the big guys that can do Black Friday stuff.
The name of the event seems kind of odd or peculiar, or at least that's what the definition of this form of bazaar is. What's the reason behind that word choice?
Well, the Bizarre, B-I-Z-A-R-R-E, it fits with our street. We've got one block that's back-end parking that's different from the rest of the city and the rest of the street. The businesses that have always been on block have been a little bit quirkier and a little bit different, I think, always. We've got a lot of those shops that have been on the street for 20 years. So I think it sort of just fits with our Keeping Fayetteville Funky and Different vibe.
Where did the idea for the Christmas Bazaar come from?
The Block Street Business Association is an event-driven association. We've found through Block Street Block Party and Block Street Bazaar that it's one of the most fun ways to promote our street. We try and do lots of hands-on projects for our street as well, like the art bike racks that we just installed. But it's also a good way for us to interact with our community and invite people to come and participate with us instead of all of us just being in our stores and waiting for people to come to us. It's a good way for us to get out and interact with the people in our neighborhood.
This is the fourth street festival that Block Street has had, including the block parties in the spring. Other than exposure to the businesses on the street, what has been gained from all the partying?
I think it makes memories on our streets. I think that when people come to our street and experience something like Block Street Bazaar or Block Street Block Party, that they remember hearing live music on our street and remember the way that we interact with their retailers. I think it's a creative way for us to interact with our customers and invite them to come along and have the fun. I mean, it is about being in business, and it's about staying in business, and it's about promoting our street. And when you're in business, it's about making the bottom line. But there are a lot of ways that you can creatively expand on that. There are a lot of ways that you can invite people to participate and feel like they're a part of your business and a part of the success on your street and have a sense of pride in the uniqueness that local independent businesses offer our community. I think it's what makes Fayetteville different, and I think it's what makes us interesting, and it's why we're happy living here and we're happy raising our kid here. I think that it loans to an individualism that no other town can offer. There's never going to be another Little Bread Company or another I Am Spa or another Good Things Boutique. Those are solely and independently, those belong to Fayetteville.
So do you feel like there are other areas in Fayetteville that could benefit from this model of just coming together as businesses, throwing celebrations for the city?
Absolutely. I think Springfest was a great example of that. That's going to be back this year. I think Autumn Fest was a great way to do that. Fayetteville Farmers Market has almost made an event of its retail business. I mean, it is about sales and it's about local farmers and it's about good food, but there's also a lot of music and a lot of art and a lot of flash mobs that we've seen this year and this past season that have sort of grown it into its own event, and it's a lot of fun.
All right, Hannah, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Hannah Withers is the president of the Block Street Businesses Association, and the Block Street Christmas Bazaar will take place this Sunday, December 2nd, from noon to 4 p.m. More information can be found on the Block Street Businesses Association's Facebook page. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Tomorrow night, Studio 3, just off the square in downtown Fayetteville, will be a blast of color. Several works by Mazur, an artist in Arkansas via Dublin, will be on exhibit. Yesterday afternoon, he was making final decisions at the studio for the hanging of his big, bold works. He took a break to tell me that he was attracted to the studio on Mountain Street because the storefront evoked something very American.
We were just having a walk around Fayetteville the day I got here, I think, or the next day. And we're looking at potential walls to paint, and I just sort of got this feeling. I walked by it, and there's something American about it, with the shop front, the inlay into the door, and just the finishings on it were sort of, I don't know what era it is, maybe 60s, 70s, but it was sort of American shop front, you know, that isn't familiar with a home in Dublin, so it just sort of appealed to me straight away.
You may have noticed he said he found the studio space while he was searching for walls to paint. That's not a euphemism. Mazur specializes in large outdoor public works on walls and edifices, sometimes several stories high.
That's my forte, is painting walls, painting murals on walls, positive messages, things that people can see and sort of hopefully get inspired by. So I was here with Steve and we're walking around looking at that, and then that's what I said, we came across this space. But that's what I do. That's my 9 to 5 really, is to paint murals and a lot of like different inspired things, maybe from the location. Like, so I ended up painting a piece just last week in Fort Smith. So I started researching the area, history of it, and I came across a man called William Darby.
William Darby, a Fort Smith native, became famous for leading Darby's Rangers during World War II, the outfit that evolved into the U.S. Army Rangers. The just-finished mural in downtown Fort Smith certainly has a contemporary feel. Bright colors surround a profile of a young Darby, and a vivid green army hat tops the portrait. Big color is common with Mazur's work, as is a not quite but almost abstract quality. It's not photorealism, but it's not hard to distinguish the characteristics of the subject either. A slightly altered, multicolored universe. He uses surprising colors to create shadows in many of the paintings he'll be exhibiting tomorrow night, such as a portrait of a skateboarding youth he met during a previous trip from Ireland to Northwest Arkansas.
It's of a young guy that I met first time I was here in March, and his nickname is Stubbs, and he's a young skater, and there's, you know, quite a story behind the kid, and, you know, it's he really intrigued me anyway. The guy that I was with Owen at the time, Irish guy, we were over painting a big mural for Steve at a skate park, and we just really gelled with the kid, and we went back to Dublin, we're talking about him, and you know, he goes through a lot of things, like a lot of other skate kids and a lot of other kids that age, a lot of things to deal with, and he was just very positive, and every time we met him, he was always upbeat and smiling, and you know, he just sort of touched us in that way, and I came back and I met him again and learnt more about his story, and I just thought it'd be fitting to just sort of do a piece for him, you know, because a lot of stuff I do here is sort of inspired from here, you know, so that's how you get inspiration. I came over like all these ideas of what I was going to do, but then it was like, I know, I'll just come here, start fresh, and then, so that, you know, he inspired me to paint that.
While the art on display tomorrow night does not represent his mural-sized work, many of the paintings are large and have subjects created as larger than life with a pop sensibility you'd recognize in the work of Roy Lichtenstein or Andy Warhol. Mazur began painting graffiti in Ireland in the mid-1990s, and his creativity can be seen not just in Fort Smith and Dublin, but Prague, Copenhagen, London, and several other cities. He wants his murals and art to be positive. In his native Dublin, he designed messages intended to deliver some amount of goodwill to passers-by.
You know, from experiences, even bad experiences, I've come up with the most positive messages to write on walls, like, you're alive, and, you know, Mazur loves you, and love yourself today. You know, I make stickers and stick them up around Dublin City. Just, and, you know, I get good feedback. People are like, you know, that makes my day when I go to work and I see that. And, you know, it's raining most of the time in Dublin, so you need a bit of positivity.
The reception for Mazur's exhibit, titled Outsider, is tomorrow night from 6 until 9 at Studio 3. That's at 3 East Mountain, just off the Fayetteville Square. He'll be there to talk about his art. He's currently also working on a book documenting the relationship between graffiti and social groups in Dublin. And you can see the new William O. Darby mural along Garrison Avenue in downtown Fort Smith. You can also see Mazur's work at Bordertown Skate Park in Fort Smith and find him on Facebook as well. He spells his name M-A-S-E-R. This is Ozarks at Large. The 2012-2013 Jazz Series at Walton Arts Center is a diverse embarrassment of riches. Already, there have been living legends like percussionist Candido, and ahead buzzed about up-and-comer Grace Kelly. Saturday night, Sean Jones brings his quartet to the Star Theater for two shows. The trumpeter has already been the lead trumpeter in the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra and toured almost every corner of the planet with musicians like Marcus Miller, Herbie Hancock, and Wayne Shorter. Recently, Sean Jones talked to Robert Ginsberg, the host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz.
Your early musical experiences included gospel music that you heard while attending St. James Church of God in Christ in Warren, Ohio, where you sang and performed with the choir. I have two questions. Do you still sing? And how directly is your approach to the trumpet informed by vocal traditions?
Good question. I actually still do sing a little bit. I typically don't do it in in performance settings with my quintet, but I still like to sing in church choir, and I still like to go back to Warren, Ohio, and sing with a couple groups there every now and then. As far as my training and how it relates to my performance, I try my best to emulate singers when I perform. Sometimes the technical aspect of playing the trumpet or playing any wind instrument for that matter can sort of get in the way and will sound mechanical, but I think that people really like to hear that kind of vocal quality and that honesty in your playing. When people sing, there's just a direct connection to the soul, and I try to get that same connection when I'm performing. Attention to the phrase. A lot of people don't pay attention to that. Because when you sing a melody, you're actually the execution of the melody is very, of course, you know, it deals with words and it deals with the melodic content of those words strung together, and that's phrasing. So when you hear a musician that's aware of that and understands what that means, then they have a direct connection to their listener.
You have a rich educational background as well as an incredibly prolific performance history. You studied classical trumpet when you were in high school. You received an undergraduate degree in classical trumpet performance from Youngstown State University, a master's from Rutgers, plus, as I mentioned, the performances that you've been involved in, including tours and recordings with Nancy Wilson, Joe Lovano. This is a short list. Frank Foster, Chaka Khan, Harry Connick Jr., Stevie Wonder. And you're currently an associate professor of jazz studies at DeQueen University. Given this background, what first drew you to teach? And I'm also curious, what's your essential philosophy for teaching music?
Well, what drew me to teaching are my teachers and how they influenced me with their actions, not just the knowledge that they gave to me and that they still give to me, but that kind of sharing and caring. I grew up in an environment where the entire community was your teacher, and there was that kind of sharing going on, and I always appreciated that. And I realized that sometimes all it takes is just saying the right word at the right time that could turn on a young mind and sort of propel them into a future that would be vibrant, just from you taking the time to recognize that maybe this one word is all they need. And I like that. I like influencing young, impressionable minds. I think that that's really important. And not just through education, but through sharing. And that's actually my central philosophy of teaching, to share, communicate, express knowledge, and being willing to learn as well. I think that the greatest teaching happens when there's a communication of ideas. And so that's my general philosophy.
Going back and looking a little bit more at some of your history, I know you joined the Lincoln Jazz Orchestra in 2004, I believe, and you began touring with the band, ultimately Wynton Marsalis asked you to be the lead trumpeter, which was a position that you accepted. Can you tell me what the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra experience was like for you?
Well, it was very interesting in that it's not a typical big band where you have the lead players, that's the lead player, and the soloist is the solo player, and that every last person in that band is a soloist and a wonderful soloist. Wynton's philosophy, if it was to be connected to a specific ensemble, would probably be Duke Ellington's ensemble, and that Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn and the folks that wrote for that band wrote for specific people, and their names would actually be on those pieces of music. And I think that's the philosophy of Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra. Wynton realizes who's in each chair, knows what they can contribute, and that's been the central philosophy for that band. So when I played lead in the band, it wasn't like, okay, here's Sean, here's the part that has all the high notes. Make sure you play those. The lead part would actually get thrown around. So although I was technically the lead trumpet chair, I wasn't necessarily a typical lead player, if that makes any sense at all.
So you weren't taking all the solos?
No, I wasn't taking all the solos. The solos were that was actually a challenge each concert. How are we going to get everybody to play? There's 16, 17 different soloists in the band. How do you feature everybody?
And all of them great.
Oh, yeah, everybody could play. Mm-hmm. Everybody. So it's really cool.
I hear in your playing a great sense of music's history and even echoes of the great jazz trumpet lineage like Clifford Brown and Miles and Freddie Hubbard and Woody Shaw. But I also hear sort of a yearning and a reaching, and I wonder, how do you balance the history of jazz with the future that you'd like to create?
Well, I think the history of jazz is in the music itself. There's certain rhythmic parts of the language, there's certain melodic quotes, there's certain things, certain melodic devices, certain harmonic devices that have been staples of the language from its inception. And I grew up playing gospel music. Gospel music is very close to blues, which is in jazz, and it's all American.
Wouldn't you agree that part of the tradition of jazz also is the reaching for something new or expanding the vocabulary, perhaps?
Definitely. I think that most jazz musicians are trying to move ahead, trying to see what the next thing is. But I think that that's a human condition. I think that most people are trying to see what's coming around the corner. I just think that jazz musicians realize that it's our duty to try to get there and try to be the sonic depiction of that desire to move ahead and to progress and to see what the next thing is.
Projects that you're currently involved in that you could share with us, any new CDs or any projects, really?
A lot of my work the past 2 years has been with two big bands, the Cleveland Jazz Orchestra in Cleveland, Ohio. I've been leading that band. That's been exciting. Been trying to get that big band out in the community and performing around Ohio, keeping that tradition alive, and also lead the Pittsburgh Jazz Orchestra. And doing the same thing in Pittsburgh. There's a lot of wonderful writers, a lot of wonderful musicians that are in both cities, and just trying to get a nice collection of those folks. I think that every major city in the country that has a symphony orchestra, they should have a jazz band, a jazz orchestra, as its counterpart. I think that it's time for us to start celebrating our American traditions and ensemble, as well as the European tradition and European classical music. So I've been doing that. I'm working on a new album. I've been reading a book called I Am by Howard Falco, and it's kind of about universalism and how everything is related. That's affecting a lot of my writing right now. So more than likely, another album will be coming in about a year. So
that's wonderful.
Those are the main projects I'm working on.
That's good news. That's very good news, Sean. And you've had a very productive and fruitful relationship with Mac Avenue, your record label, with 6 recordings, and they just keep getting better, Sean.
Thank you. I'm still with them, and I hope that they still stick with me.
Well, it's exciting to know that you'll be here in December 1st with this incredible ensemble, and I'm thrilled to hear that your longtime bandmates, Oren and Lucas, and I think Lucas was here. I'm trying to remember if he was with Dave Valentin some years back. Or,
that sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, I think I met him with Dave Valentin and loved his playing. But I've never seen drummer Ralph Peterson before, so that will be very exciting.
Hold on to your hat.
Yeah, man. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
I dig it. Thanks much, man.
Thank you. Looking forward, Sean.
See you soon.
The Sean Jones Quartet will play 2 shows, 7 and 9, Saturday night at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. His latest CD is titled No Need for Words. You can learn more about him at seanjonesmusic.com and more about his shows Saturday night at waltonartscenter.org. He talked with Robert Ginsberg, the host of KUAS Shades of Jazz. You can hear that program each Friday and Saturday night beginning at 10.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 28th of November, 2012. It's the birthday of Brooks Atkinson, born Melrose, Massachusetts, 1894, who reviewed plays for more than 4 decades for the New York Times. After he was done at the theater, he came back to the Times office, lit up his pipe, wrote the whole review by hand on a yellow legal pad, and as he finished each page, he would hand it to a copy boy to go and type it. It's the birthday of the writer and physicist Alan Lightman, Memphis, 1948. His first novel, Einstein's Dreams, made up of 30 dreams that Lightman imagined Albert Einstein might have had during the months of 1905 when he was working on his theory of special relativity. It's the birthday of the poet William Blake, London, 1757. He was little known in his own lifetime, regarded as a lunatic by most people who knew him, died in poverty at the age of 69. In 30 years, he had sold fewer than 20 copies of his Songs of Innocence and of Experience. But 3 years after he died, he was mentioned in a popular 6-volume encyclopedia of British artists. And then one of his admirers, Alexander Gilchrist, set out to write his biography. It was published in 1863. Blake had died in 1827. Life of William Blake, and it was hugely popular. And for the first time, thanks to a biography, William Blake was considered a major English poet. And it's the birthday of the novelist Rita Mae Brown, born Hanover, Pennsylvania, 1944. When she was in her late 20s, she wrote a novel, Ruby Fruit Jungle, came out in 1973, the coming-of-age story of Molly Bolt and her lesbian experiences in high school. The book was rejected by many publishers, finally printed by a small feminist publishing house, a few thousand copies. The book was not carried in big bookstores. It was sold by mail. It didn't get a single review, but it became a word-of-mouth hit, and Ruby Fruit Jungle has now sold more than a million copies. Here's a poem by William Blake on his birthday, a poem about an annual event in London when the orphans of the Foundling Hospital were marched en masse to St. Paul's Cathedral to sing. The poem entitled Holy Thursday. 'Twas on a holy Thursday, their innocent faces clean, the children walking two and two in red and blue and green. Gray-headed beadles walked before with wands as white as snow, till into the high dome of Paul's they like Thames waters flow. Oh, what a multitude they seemed, these flowers of London town. Seated in companies they sit, with radiance all their own. The hum of multitudes was there, but multitudes of lambs, thousands of little boys and girls raising their innocent hands. Now like a mighty wind they raise to heaven the voice of song, or like harmonious thunderings the seats of heaven among. Beneath them sit the aged men, wise guardians of the poor. Then cherish pity, lest you drive an angel from your door. Holy Thursday by William Blake. That's the Writer's Almanac, sponsored by the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition, offering articles from international writers about finances to art, food, wine, and culture. You can celebrate the weekend at subscribe.wsj.com/getweekend. And by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Harrison. And now time to name or to pick the winner of two Billy Elliot tickets to opening night at Walton Arts Center, Tuesday night, December 4th. Also, four tickets to any Malco movie theater in the area and a beautiful copy of the 2013 Tim Ernst calendar just out. The question that you had to answer via email at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com was named two generals who became president, excluding Grant, Washington, and Eisenhower. 12 generals eventually became president of the United States. I took out the three that I thought everybody knew, Grant, Washington, Eisenhower. You just had to come up with two. More than three dozen people instantly got it. Several. This is the most answers we've had on one of these ever. First of all, the list of who you could have put down. Benjamin Harrison, William Henry Harrison, Rutherford B. Hayes, James Garfield, Zachary Taylor, Andrew Johnson. All became Franklin Pierce as well, right? Yes. And the winner for this time, we'll pull out of the ceramic cow, is Bob Estes of Fayetteville. Congratulations. Bob mentioned Andrew Jackson and William Henry Harrison. Thanks, everyone who put in your answers. Sorry, everyone can't win. Those are the last two Billy Elliot tickets we have. We still have many more movie passes and Tim Ernst calendars. We'll be giving them away throughout the rest of this month. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellens. Christina Thomas will be with me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio tomorrow for another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. And once again, thanks to the Fayetteville Public Library and Theater Squared for inviting me to moderate last night's forum about the next Theater Squared production, Period of Adjustment. You'll hear highlights from that on next Tuesday's program.